So I've got 40 minutes, and there's so many themes that I've sort of awakened. Not completely sure what, or haven't been completely sure what to do, but I'm going to take one particular theme because it's one I've been exploring recently that I think could help us to understand a little bit more fully the topic. And it again arises in connection with, I suppose, looking at Bhante's hidden teachings. find a way in. So it's related to the theme of Kalyanamitrata. So if you know what Kalyanamitrata means. You know that Mitrata, of course, means friendship, and Kalyana is a word that means beautiful, morally good, but with a sort of connotation of beauty as well. It can even mean physically beautiful. There's a famous railway station on the line between Bombay and Pune called Kalyan, and it's about the ugliest place you could possibly know. It's a bit like coming with Maitrevir from Punjab to Delhi, and we passed a station called Adarsh. Adarsh means ideal. So we looked out the window and it seemed to be sort of pit. Anyway, Kalyan is not representative of the Kalyana. Kalyana means, in the first place, yes, the beautiful, the morally good. But it has the connotation of coming from a definitely dhammic dimension, coming from beyond the merely self-related, coming from the transcendent level, if you like. So Kalyanamitrata is a friendship that connects you with the good, the beautiful, but ultimately also with the Dharma. So the question is, how does that work? What's the mechanism of it in one's own experience? So I need to provide a little bit of background theory. I've been talking about this on recent retreats, so I might get some help from the audience here. But you know that, of course, the central Buddhist insight is that there is no fixed self. There's no fixed anything. There is only pratityasamuppada. There is only a flow of conditioned arisings. Within that... So what happens? How do we end up with a sense of a fixed I in a fixed universe? That's where we are, isn't it? We think, here I am, there is a world out there that somehow exists independent of my experience of it. And that hypothesis is pretty good. It works under most circumstances. According to later Buddhist tradition, the Yogacara, which Bhante thinks probably has the clearest exposition of these sort of issues, what happens is that experience is naturally articulated in terms of an inward perceiving dimension and an outward perceived aspect. That's natural to the way in which we experience. We're all sitting here. Our senses deliver to us, and our perceptual mechanisms deliver to us an impression of a world out there, which is, as it were, focused inly, is perceived from within. Do you see what I mean? That naturally happens. That happens to dogs, and it happens to Buddhas. It's just part of the way that the mechanism, the organism, is put together. It delivers to you experiences which the senses pick up and interpret at a very basic level, in terms of what you feel right close to you here, in here, as it were, and what is out there distant from you. That is part of the given. It's not either enlightened or unenlightened for that to take place. It's simply what happens. As long as you've got a body, as long as you've got senses, they will deliver to you experience. That experience will have what the Yogacara calls the darshana bhaga. The darshana means seeing part, bhaga means part. And a nimitta bhaga. Nimitta means sign or image. And here it means really object of sensory experience. So a dimension that is, as it were, objective. Yeah, broadly you could say there's a subjective and objective dimension of all experience. So when we say transcending the subject-object distinction, it's really quite misleading. Because you can't transcend them while you've got a body. That's the way things come. But according to Yogacara, the problem is, and this really simply brings out what is in basic Buddhism, in Buddha's own direct teaching, the problem is we seize hold of the inward perceiving dimension and think of it as being part of or belonging to a fixed, permanent I that stands outside the perceiving moment. Do you see what I mean? And a fixed world of which the external, the experiences that appear externally are experiences. This is very sort of very much the territory that Kant and Schopenhauer and the philosophers of that era were exploring, even back to Hume and the idealists, looking at the way in which there's the sensory, it's not just the sensory data, the mechanisms of perception, the mechanisms of awareness deliver a world which we then read in terms of a fixed unitary self internal and a fixed unitary world external of which the experiences are experiences. That's, according to basic Buddhist theory, the source of all our suffering. Because we fix our experience in terms of this inner self and this outer world, we think that we can we have deep attachment to that inner self, and we want to make it solid and safe and to give it happiness and pleasure. And we think that we can find in that solid, fixed world out there a permanent set of affairs that will deliver us a secure self-experience and pleasant self-experience. That's the basic delusion. So what Yogacara does is it distinguishes between these two bhaga, these two parts, darshana and nimitta, inward perceiving and outward perceived aspects, and distinguishes between those and the grasping onto self and the grasping onto or the that which is grasped, the grasper and the grasped, grahaka, which is grasper, and grahya, which is grasped. So we read into this naturally occurring flow of experience with its two broad dimensions, which are not actually sharply differentiated, but which are graded from one end to the other, so to speak. We read into that a fixed internal subject. But it's not just a sort of idea, it's a powerful attachment. So the sense of self, the sense of Atman is not merely a conceptual construction. This is how you hear it spoken of sometimes. It has a conceptual dimension, but it is strongly, strongly affective. It's strongly, strongly connected with clinging. The very idea is wrapped up with clinging. It presumably you can provide a kind of evolutionary explanation if you want to. Buddhist theory is sort of rather unsatisfactory. It simply says that you've got it because you had it before, which you know, it is not interested in origins in that way. So it simply says that the Yogacara argues that the momentum of previous clinging on to self leads to the renewed clinging on to self. Krishna Manavijnana re-emerges and clings again, turns back, sees the Darshanabhaga, says, that's me, and I want it. And I'm going to fight to keep it, as it were. So this is the process that we're working to overcome. We're working to recognize that these are constructed. We're not working to get rid of the inward perceiving and the outward perceived aspect. Quite important sort of conceptual distinction. Otherwise you can get quite confused about what you're trying to do. And it's sort of as if you're trying to end up as a big kind of blank blob. Some of us are like that now, but you're not trying to aim at that. You will, even when you do enter the stream of the Dhamma, internal experiences will emerge and external experiences will emerge, all, you know, as I say, finely graded in a single field of consciousness. So that's the fundamental issue, that there's very strong, deep attachment to self, and then that self grasps onto those aspects of experience that seem to confirm and solidify that self-identity, and to react against those aspects of experience that threaten it, and that we believe threaten it. So this is a fundamental Buddhist analysis. And this is merely a conceptual analysis. Just because you've understood it doesn't mean you're entered the stream. But at least to understand it is quite an important basis for further reflection. To watch this going on in your experience, this something gets added in to the experience. Something, for instance, a car goes by and splashes you with water. And, you know, you get wet, and that's not very nice. But then a sort of indignation takes over. Maybe I'm just confessing here. But, you know, you start to feel that they deliberately chose to do it to you. And you start to personalise it. For instance, just to take at random, something that sort of made itself up in my mind. But you can think of many examples like that. Instead of just sort of seeing what happened, just there it was, that happened, you add in an element of indignation, of resentment, of craving, whatever it is, that's quite extraneous to the particularities of what happened. Your sense of self-grasping gets added in. So a lot of our practice needs to be noticing that, is what you do with Satipatthana. You notice that getting added in. And you can't necessarily stop it immediately. You notice it and you try to sort of reflect, well, where did that come from? Who is that? Where's that coming from? And so on. So that you begin to recognize that this is unnecessary. It's very difficult to spot to begin with, but after a while you can just spot it, usually in moments of reaction, whether, you know, external hot or internal cold or whatever, whether for or against, you notice it in those sort of situations. So, this structure creates a dynamic of craving and aversion, a movement from this putative self, this imputed self, to this imputed other. Do you see what I mean? That we read into the situation something that does the grasping and something that's grasped. And it's a very strong current towards it and also away from it. a movement of craving or attraction, clinging, and a movement of aversion and rejection, repulsion, that emerges out of this bifurcation of our experience in terms of a really existent grasped self and a really existent grasped world, external to the flow of darshanabhaga and nimittabhaga. That's where we're all at. As we sit here, that's where we're at. Of course, in a very refined and gentle and sympathetic sort of way, on the whole. Except when Subhuti gets a bit strong, maybe. That's sort of going on for us. So how do we get out of it? How on earth do we get out of it? Because that's where our energy is. Our energy is all sort of caught up with this flow of clinging and aversion. And really, when it's not going on, we're often more or less dead. We're just sort of in a numb state. You know, that's somewhere in the middle. That's, in fact, in certain traditions, that's what moha means. It's this state of lack of affect, where you've kind of collapsed inwardly, and you go into a sort of shock unresponsiveness. How do you get out of it? How do you even know that you can get out of it? And how do you motivate yourself to get out of it? Well, you need something within that framework that evokes what lies outside that framework. This is really the one of the major arts of Dhamma life. You need something that, while you're lost within that framework, uses or appeals to forces that are within that framework, but that itself points to something beyond it. It's very clear, but I don't know whether it's very clear, or whether it communicates. So, of course, the most ready image for an illustration purpose, it may not actually work for you, is for instance, a Buddha image. The more beautiful the image is, the more it sums up for you these qualities that lie outside that framework. In other words, the more it appeals to forces that arise within that framework, the forces of attraction in their more sublimated form of aesthetic attraction, the more powerfully it can motivate you to get out of that framework. Do you see me? We need what Bhante calls intermediaries. We need experiences that lie within our ordinary framework of desire and repulsion, but that echo with something beyond them. This is really what the practice of spiritual rebirth is about. And it's what Bhante refers to as the transcendental object. You need something that translates what lies outside the framework of clinging and aversion, the framework of self-attachment and other attachment. You need something that reflects that, and reflects what lies beyond that within it. So the needs to be an image, can be an idea, although idea in more than a conceptual sense, idea in the sort of sense of a living kind of mental image or picture. Can't think of the right word for it. Vision almost, but without pictures. You need that, or a connection with people, a connection with places, that evokes a strong response of attraction, which is based upon, emerges from your ordinary craving. It's connected to your ordinary craving, if you see what I mean. And It's not that you've got ordinary craving and then you've got sort of another kind of craving. You've got karma chanda and dhamma chanda. They're kind of the same force, the same energy, but that force or energy takes an object that really does attract and appeal at even the karmic level, but that zooms beyond itself. This is why I've been, you know, rather provocatively talking about the erotic. So I wanted to try to get us back to, it's following Bhante, I'm sure you wouldn't dare go anywhere else. We need to recognise that our spiritual life is powered by our ordinary human emotions and motives. But those ordinary human emotions and motives that connect to something that goes beyond them. This is the art of it. And the art of a successful spiritual life, a Dhamma life, I'm trying to stop using the word spiritual, the art of a successful Dhamma life is to find things that you really do engage with that point beyond themselves. Of course, this is really what art does at a lower level. I mean, it can be at a higher level too, but art often does reflect deeper values and higher experience, if perhaps often short of the dhammic. But you know, you're really drawn in, you're really engaged, your ordinary emotions engage. You don't turn on a special emotion. It uses the juice of your ordinary dualistic, if you like, desires, and connects with something that is capable of drawing you onto another level. This is Kalyanamitrata. Kalyanamitrata is the intermediary. On many levels, not always on the level of the completely dharmic, as it were. Often, you know, we Kalyanamitras are not capable of that altogether. We can connect you with what does connect you with that, so we can be intermediaries to the intermediaries. But you need to connect, and it's Kalyanamitrata that connects you within the field of your ordinary desire with what lies beyond that field, if you see what I mean. I think that the secret of successful Dhamma life. You need to find where your attractions are. I remember a delightful occasion in Lucknow, which is in UP, where Taranya comes from, and it's the centre of an ancient Urdu culture. Very, very beautiful, but not ancient actually. It was alive, still alive, with music, poetry, very, very beautiful, very sophisticated and subtle culture. And I had a retreat there, and one of my friends there, one of our mitras there, is very interested in Lucknavi culture. He always gets me to dress in a Lucknavi kurta, which is a little lacy for me, but not very butch. But he got a kawal, a Muslim kawal, to come, Haider Baksh Khan. And he'd asked this kawal. Kawal is a Sufi musical form, which very, very inspired, very rich at its best. You're looking pained. Have I said something wrong? No, it's okay. My friend had Rajesh Chandra had given him some mantras and things like that, and he did one on Mani Padme Hum, which is actually very beautiful, very, very attractive. And that seemed to sort of work that time. And then it came again to Bodh Gaya, and on a big retreat that we had, and he just couldn't get it. Couldn't get us. And first of all, he asked me to come up on the stage. You know, silly fool, I went and sat on the stage. And I realised what he was doing was trying to direct people's devotion towards me. Very fortunately, we don't do that in our movement, and I haven't got the long beard and the long hair and all that. But in the Sufi tradition, the peer is the master is as an object of devotion. I think quite rightly we don't do that. So he couldn't get them going. You know, he would be singing and go, "Whoa," to me, you know, to me as it were. And I was looking more and more English and embarrassed and awkward and trying to pretend I wasn't there. You know, the audience sort of, you know, quite enjoying it, humming along, but not really roused. Because in a real koala, in the end, has everybody, you know, flowing towards the beloved, the transcendent, if you like, when they're really successful. He just couldn't get them going. So you could see him sort of working around, fiddling around. And then he started doing it towards the Buddha. And he sort of went, "Wow," you know, like that. Again, couldn't really get a rise out of them. And finally, he started on Dr. Ambedkar, which is where many people's sort of juices are, as it were. And then suddenly they were all with him and clapping along and singing with him, etc., etc. He said under his breath in Indian, somebody translated it for me, "Now I know where your love is." This is the Sufis are the masters of love in this sense. Love in the sense of this powerful eros attraction towards something that lies outside the situation of craving, of clinging. Lies within it. Sorry, that lies within it, but points to something outside it. They're the masters of that. And I found that really, really revealing. We need to find where our love is. We need to see where the blessings lie, where they can flow towards us. And it's not a simple process. It's a process of exploration, sometimes quite untidy, which is, of course, where, you know, problems often lie. But you need to be finding in your own experience that which can hold the ideal, which can be an archetype for you of what lies outside and beyond, and especially can be a holder of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, so that you can enter into a relationship with it. Otherwise, what happens is that our Dhamma life is sort of apart from us. It's a kind of idealized, somewhat bloodless life that we live on Thursday nights, or, you know, when we meditate. But the art of spiritual life is connecting up where we really are now with what lies beyond where we are now. And it's a delicate, sensitive, problematic process, which often involves wrong turnings and paradoxes and so forth. You know, like you get situations where, for instance, people will have been trying to meditate on some Buddha or Bodhisattva. You know, they like the idea of this Buddha or Bodhisattva. They've been doing that practice faithfully and so forth. And suddenly, the wretched Virgin Mary comes into your meditation. And you find yourself inspired by her. This is not my personal experience. Bhante did have that experience. He didn't seem to bother about it. But, you know, something that sort of shouldn't be there, maybe what takes you. So Kalyana Mitrata is the mediation of what lies beyond the framework of clinging, but lies within the framework of clinging. Of course, that's in the highest and most idealized sense of it. For me, somebody like Bhante has really been able to embody that. That there's a touch in him, not merely, I'm sure, projected by me. There's a touch in him of the Dhamma. I remember a very, very powerful experience in the last bout of sleeplessness he had. He found it very difficult to relax unless somebody was with him. He needed somebody to be there, probably to do with the effect of these wretched drugs again. He clearly wasn't at ease. In my kind of naive ideas still intact, even after all those years, I found myself thinking, God, who's this guy? Who's this Waller? And absolutely at the same moment that thought came into my mind, I realised that in the room, in a way I cannot explain to you, there was a vast consciousness, as if the roof came off and the blue sky just stood all around me. So that this man who was experiencing, probably the Manu Niyama process, is experiencing a very difficult and painful mental state. At the same time, was in contact with something that completely outside that. Very difficult to explain. I don't know whether I've communicated anything by saying that. But that's my feeling with him, that even when I've I've been annoyed with him or disagreed with him or whatever, sooner or later I realise, yeah, maybe that could have been put differently or whatever, but there's something much more there. So for me, he's been able to embody that. There's been a Kalyanamitra in the fullest and truest sense. He's definitely somebody I can come into a relationship, I can have attraction to, and I can have repulsion from, be irritated with, and deeply respect and like at times, and enjoy his company and so on, and at the same time sometimes find him frustrating and uncooperative and so on and so forth. It's probably when he's most useful to me, when he's uncooperative. That's another story. But of course, you're not going to meet that very often. What you're mostly going to meet is people like me and the other order members, who are pretty good, but they maybe, themselves don't yet have sufficient contact with that. But at the same time, they're related to it. So it's as if through their own practice, in their commitment to the three jewels, they are able to mediate the mediator, if you see what I mean. So, and then you, in your turn, can do that. Do you see what I mean? So that we establish situations in which there's a connection, whether direct or indirect, that's in our situation, but that connects us directly or indirectly to what lies beyond it, outside it. My own view is that the whole movement does embody that, although imperfectly and patchily, and at times almost denying itself or defying itself. But that if you are at all charitable and certainly quite open, you will encounter that spirit there, mediated through your contact, especially with your spiritual friends. Not only order members, but especially those who are more experienced within the order. You will experience that. And what you need to do is to come into deeper connection and relationship. I think it might be what Guhya Prabha was trying to get at, that the main thing is, whatever the difficulties are, stay in relationship and believe that there's something there. Believe that it's worth it. If you really come to the point where you can't believe it, it's not worth it. Don't waste your time. Don't waste others' time. I won't get polemic, don't worry. Just go away. No, I didn't say that. But if you can, if you really have an ounce of confidence left, stay in relationship. Try to filter out, that time. Oddly, the moment when I sort of had a momentary loss of confidence in Bhante, I experienced what he was really like. Very strange. absence can often be the most powerful way of experiencing presence, if you see what I mean. So I hope I've sort of given you a bit of a framework for thinking further about Kalyanamitta. I've spoken quite sort of principally and, well, of course, conceptually. And, of course, I haven't spoken about the everyday reality of Kalyanamitta because, well, I haven't got time. And because, in a way, I think the most important thing is to get a bit more of a glimpse of this this mechanism that we need to be activating, this mechanism of finding equivalence within the framework of clinging for something that lies beyond it, and working skillfully with that. Of course, all the practices that we do in principle work at that. Integration means that you, you're making yourself more and more fit to open yourself. You're changing your experience, you're changing your consciousness so that it can actually open to the Dhamma. It's not just bifurcated, it goes into bit of it but not the rest. You're working with your spiritual motivations, with your karma, through metta bhavana and everything of that kind. You're working to make yourself more and more receptive so that you've got the capacity to respond. You're trying to see through that structure that I talked about, the structure of craving, structure of graha and grahya. Yes, you're struggling to try to identify within your ordinary experience those objects which take the force of your desire and point beyond itself, if you see what I mean. I think a lot of Blake is all about this. Bring me my arrows of desire. That's what he's talking about. Those arrows of desire are not just desire in the Cupid sense, Eros, you see. They're arrows of desire in the Platonic sense of Eros, the sense that that sense. You're trying to use the force of attraction, what draws you to something that points beyond itself. That's faith. Faith is initially a response to whatever evokes the transcendent, transcending, that is, the self-clinging, the framework of misunderstanding about ourselves. So I hope that's been useful, because we're timed out. And of course, it would be really good to have more discussion and more, even some questioning about that. But I wanted to sort of present this framework, because it sort of got a bit clearer to me after my discussions with Bhante. Because I think it enables us to link both the ideal and the real, if you see what I mean. And it's something that I remember on the Tuscany that Ruchiraketu was ordained on. This was a very strong theme of Bhante's. The intermediary, the messenger, the angel. The angel comes into our world but points to something that goes beyond our world. Hermes, the messenger of the gods, who stands in, brings the message into our world of something beyond it. And he considers that there's a great danger in Western culture of losing these intermediaries. It's a very interesting theme in itself. Most cultures have a developed sense of an intermediary world. Even cultures that are not necessarily literary cultures, but cultures that have a very strong sense of a connection with forces that are not merely human. And of course, in the most sophisticated cultures of the past, this is very strong. But since the European Enlightenment, there's been a kind of an accentuating of intellect and sensation, the sensory world, the ordinary sensory world, and the world of intellect. And what lies between those two has become more problematic for us. But it's the key to real human evolution, the key to real humanity. And it's what we need to work with most fundamentally if we are successfully to bring a new Dhamma world into existence for ourselves and for others. So I hope that I've given a little bit of a framework there, and I don't know whether you're going to be doing some talking later on. I'd be very interested to hear if there are any follow-up to what I've said, and I will try to pursue this a bit further in other contexts. But for myself, I'm very glad to have been with you and to explore rather at random issues that come connected with Kalyanamitrita. This is my way these days. I just go where I find things interesting or inspiring. So I hope that I've done what I was supposed to do, Padre Devi.